Greetings once again, America. My name is Doug McBurney, and you may have heard the news, but stand by now for the worldview. That's right, it is the Weekly Worldview. I am your humble host, Doug McBurney, here alongside my extremely attractive audio engineer on the show where we don't take calls, we don't tolerate sponsors, but we do focus on the events of the week through the lens of original thought. Actually, the events of the last few weeks, because we've been out on the road. The entire McBurney clan escaped to parts southwest where it was warmer as the deep freeze engulfed the nation. And we're back in, back in a mile high now. And the temperature is over 60 degrees. That was the condition upon which we would return. The temperature had to climb above 60 degrees before we would return because it's simply inhuman to live in temperatures below 60 degrees, in our humble opinion. And so, but we are back, and we're glad to have you back. This is going to be a little more mellow show than usual. So just sit back, relax, and enjoy the soothing, cooling sounds of the Weekly Worldview. We like to start with something uplifting and or lighthearted. And, well, this story isn't lighthearted, but it is uplifting. It's from the War File. A group of Muslim militants attending a suicide bombing training class outside of Baghdad were killed when their commander accidentally conducted a demonstration with a live suicide belt that was actually packed with real explosives. And I think that the typical protocol involves using a belt that doesn't have real explosives when you're trying to teach people how to blow themselves up. But he grabbed a live belt, allegedly by accident. But I heard a great interview on the radio. I can't remember who it was. Someone wrote a book about these suicide bombers and how they're basically more suicidal than anything else. Far more suicidal than ideological when you look at their life stories and you read some of their writings. So maybe he just grabbed the belt, the live belt, because he was having a bad day. But anyways, the militants belong to a group that we've reported on extensively here at the Weekly Worldview, ISIS, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, which, according to this New York Times article, they're fighting the Iraqi government there in Anbar province. They're the ones who retook Fallujah and all that. Anyway, in this accident, 22 ISIS members were killed and 15 were wounded, including the instructor. And this is possibly more ISIS members were killed in this one event than have been killed by the entire Iraqi army all year. And perhaps our only hope for leaving something resembling a state in Iraq that's not an Islamic state, our only hope could be the ineptitude or perhaps the suicidal tendencies of our enemies there. So a nice uplifting story to start the show. I hope that sets the mood for the rest of the smooth, mellow sounds as we move on. The Ayatollah Khamenei, according to Reuters, he said in a speech last week, we're going to stay in the Middle East for a little while, so just bear with me here. Ayatollah Khamenei said in a speech last week that the United States would overthrow the Iranian government if it could. He said, quote, American officials publicly say they do not seek regime change in Iran. That's a lie. They wouldn't hesitate a moment if they could do it, said Ayatollah Khamenei. I don't know where he gets that idea. How could he possibly have that idea? I mean, the Barry and Kerry show, are trying to make a deal with him. And doesn't he remember the spring of 2009, the actual Arab Spring, when an uprising began against the Ayatollah and his minions there? And what did America do? Well, nothing. At least not officially. No one in the government, no one in the military. Just allowed the uprising to be crushed by the mullahs. But maybe he doesn't remember that. Or maybe he views the world through a different prism than those of us living in reality. Anyway, I want to talk about what I'm going to dub a zombie bias in the news media. Yes, a zombie bias. That is the tendency to report things as if they're true simply because they've become a part of the template that is used in the mainstream media. Reuters, the reporter who wrote this story, he writes, Khamenei has given his guarded support to the nuclear negotiations being led by the new reformist government of President Hassan Rouhani. It's part of the template. They have to put that there as if it's true, as if Hassan Rouhani is a reformist, when he's nothing close to a reformist. He's an Islamist, beholden to the mullahs, just like the other guy in the dirty sport coat before him. I forget his name already. Anyway, but they put that in there because it's a part of the template, just like this next statement. Iran says its nuclear program is peaceful. Western powers suspect that the program is cover for pursuing nuclear weapons. Yeah, it's just part of the template. They just put it in there as if that could be considered even close to true by anyone with half a brain. Because I guess that's what they teach you at Columbia, School of Journalism, before you go to work for Reuters. Anyway, so that's what's happening in the Middle East. Oh, there's more. There's more from the Middle East. This is from the Times of Israel. Iran, according to the Times of Israel, Iran now has all the technical infrastructure to produce a nuclear weapon, should it make the political decision to do so. So says the director of the American National Intelligence, James Clapper. He wrote that in a report to the Senate Intelligence Committee that was published, was it last week? Could have been last week. Could have been the week before. And Clapper reported that Tehran has made significant advances recently to the point where it could produce and deliver nuclear bombs, should it be so inclined. In the past year alone, Iran, has enhanced its centrifuge designs, increased the number of centrifuges, and amassed a larger quantity of lower-enriched uranium. Iran has agreed under this. Now, you know, we're making a deal with them, even as they are hurtling toward nuclear capability. We've made some kind of deal. It's rather nebulous as to what the deal is. I think the bottom line is they're allowed to get their bomb. That's the main crux of the deal. But Clapper says that Iran has agreed under the new interim deal. We don't know what he's agreed to because we don't really know what the deal is, and Clapper doesn't know much of anything. And so, but he says that they're going to provide some transparency, and this transparency would provide us with earlier warning of a breakout using the facilities. If Iran decides to make a bomb, under the new deal with the Barry and Kerry show, apparently we'll be able to tell maybe 45 minutes sooner, something like that. I don't know. What does Clapper say here? We got more from Clapper. He says, quote, we do not know if Iran will eventually decide to build nuclear weapons, at which point he should have been fired for even stating that with a straight face. What else? Anything else? Well, the Times of Israel reports that the next round of interim nuclear negotiations with Iran is expected to be held in New York next month unless it is delayed by a nuclear detonation somewhere in the Middle East or overhead in Washington, D.C. I added that last part. They didn't report that, the Times of Israel. It's just my prognostication. Now let's move from the relatively unimportant information coming out of the Middle East. Let's move back here to America and get down to the stories that are important to you and me and our ruling elite, and that, of course, relates to transgender and gay issues. In Annapolis, Maryland, apparently, according to CBS in Washington, a transgender candidate has announced that he, she, it will run against an openly homosexual senator in a Democratic primary. Apparently, the senator isn't quite perverted enough for this. Well, the tranny actually went all the way across to the other side and isn't quite happy with the level of perversion and deviance expressed by this senator. And so the homosexual will be primaried by the tranny. He, she, it is the executive director of gender rights in Maryland, and he, she, it says that she's going to run against, who is this person? Well, we'll get to that. We're going to run against Senator Richard Maddaleno, who's been an advocate for gay and transgender rights in Maryland, but he didn't go through all the way with the whole, he didn't get the operation, so he's just not qualified. And so the person, I'm not going to say its name because I don't know if it started as a boy and ended up as a girl, or if it was a girl and ended up as a boy. I don't know if it dates boys or girls or what, so it's very confusing, and it has a very gender-neutral name, and I don't want to give he, she, it any publicity, except to just comment on the level of insanity that is enveloping the Democrat Party. The tranny says that Maryland residents have waited too long for economic fairness and equal opportunity. So a socialist slash communist, along with being transgendered from one way to the other, we're not sure which way. But there you have it. Now, more important news from the transgender front. From the Press Herald up in Maine, the rights of a transgendered girl were violated, apparently, when school administrators made her use a staff bathroom at her elementary school instead of the girls' room. Now, when I say her, I don't know if it's a her. I don't know if it's a he that became a her and now wants to use a... I think that must be it. Must be a he who became a she because the administrators were uncomfortable letting her use the girls' bathroom. And they asked her to please use a staff bathroom, a gender-neutral bathroom, because other students felt uncomfortable about the fact that someone who was a boy last semester, who's a girl now, wants to go in their bathroom. Well, lawyers representing the transgendered person said that this decision, saying that her rights were violated, could lay a foundation for the emerging rights of people who identify as the opposite of their birth gender. Well, I couldn't agree more. This will lay a foundation. The foundation is being laid for the abolition of the opposite sexes. At least in the minds of the demented liberal mainstream media and the courts and our governing authorities, our ruling elites. Now, when it comes down to real bare bones, where the rubber meets the road, there's still going to be boys and girls. There'll still be a few normal people left, but we'll be relegated to second-class citizen status because we just haven't been enlightened enough to declare ourselves homosexual and then eventually, of course, get the operation go all the way. So, yes, the foundation is being laid, and this decision will be a part of it. The disturbing part of this story to me is this quote from Wayne Mains. This is the abused girls, boys, the tranny person. This is the tranny person's pervert father. He says, quote, "I'm extremely proud of our state and our leaders and what they did." He's proud of it. This is the father. This is the person to whom the young transgendered, abused, mentally ill, possibly demented child is to look to for guidance in the world and in right and wrong and all of that. And the father is proud that the court has found that his daughter's mental illness should be celebrated by everyone. And no one should feel uncomfortable, and there are no male and female anymore, and all that. Just very disturbing. So as the threat of nuclear proliferation at the very least, and some nuclear destruction at the worst, builds across the world, frankly, here in America, seem to be obsessed with all of that. And so I'm not going to do this story about steroid use amongst homos. I'm not going to do it because, well, I don't want you people to think I'm obsessed, and frankly, it's disgusting to think of homos taking steroids. So we're just going to pass on that story. I'll thank my other brother Daryl for sending it over, but I've had enough. I can't do anymore. But I do want to cover this story about Barry Hose, dope dealer in high school. Yes, this is a story that got very little attention in the mainstream media here in America. But I've got a story here from overseas, from the Daily Mail in London, about Barry Hose High School dope dealer. You see, there was a fella who ran around with Barry in the Choom Gang in his high school days, and his name was Raymond Boyer. And he was known to Barry and his friends in the Choom Gang as Gay Ray. Uh-huh. Yeah, Gay Ray. Now, I don't know about you people, but when an older fella, now this fella, how much, let's see how old he was. He was several years older than the other boys in the Chum Gang, although older than Barry and the gang. This article says he was an integral part of the Chum Gang, known for his ability to score marijuana and drive them to wherever it is they drove to quote, party. Yeah. And Obama even thanked him in his high school yearbook. Thanks to the Chum Gang and Ray for all the good times. Yeah. So, I don't know about you people, but when I was in high school, there were older guys who were known to kind of want to hang around with the high school kids, the boys especially, and they would often have access to drugs and alcohol. And it was well known what the deal was, why they hung out with high school boys. It wasn't to just party and have fun, and get high and get drunk with the boys. These were deviant, pervert homosexuals who were on the make for high school kids. And Barry was, well, he was real close with this guy, thanks him in his yearbook. I mean, everyone I thanked in my yearbook, I knew them pretty well. Anyway, so just one more layer of suspicion about the life and times of one Barack Hussein Obama, knowing that he hung around with a homosexual drug dealer, who, by the way, was eventually bludgeoned to death by a male prostitute. Yeah, and that there's disturbing. This whole story is disturbing. This homosexual prostitute who bludgeoned Gay Ray to death, he was sentenced to life in prison for the murder. Here's what happened. On New Year's Day in 1986, this homosexual prostitute took a claw hammer and beat Gay Ray's brains out. And it says he had meant to shoot him, but he couldn't get a gun. Bludgeoned him to death. It was a very ugly scene. The homosexual prostitute was, although jailed for life, was released in 2007. He was released from prison. And what else? Oh, he now has a wife. And has since, he's been convicted of some minor drug offenses. But the Daily Mail reports that he does hold down a job. And his wife, Elizabeth, told the newspaper that the episode of, well, her husband's bludgeoning to death of Gay Ray, she says that episode should be a warning to everyone and that, quote, my husband is embarrassed about it, unquote. Embarrassed? He beat the guy to death with a claw hammer and he's embarrassed? Well, there's a comment on the state of justice in America, if nothing else. Anyway, the Daily Mail goes on to conclude, Obama has never hidden his drug-taking youth and recently said on record that he felt that marijuana was no worse than alcohol. Yes, but he's made abundantly clear that guns are far more dangerous than claw hammers. It's the Weekly World View. I am your host, Doug McBurney. So glad to be back here behind the microphone talking to all you people who tune in. I'm sorry we left you for, was it 2 weeks we missed? This is the third week. It seems like an awfully long time. But while we're away, the temperature plunged below zero for several days here in Colorado. So for us, it was worth it. And plus, I was working. Yes, always working. Trying to put food on the table, as they say. Although that's really an overstatement these days. But anyway, let's get back to it. We were just talking about Barry and Gay Ray and bludgeoning and marijuana. So let's, of course, if you're talking about marijuana, you do have to talk about Colorado. As we were out and about on the road throughout several southwestern states, we noted that, as usual, all the local news they have at least one story about Colorado and the dope and the. Our state has become a laughingstock around the country. And I want to personally apologize to everyone outside of the state of Colorado for the embarrassing nature of our behavior as of late. And, well, I it's coming soon to a theater near you. Yeah. Let's see here. This is a story from USA Today. Widespread raids back in November targeted more than a dozen Colorado pot dispensaries, warehouses, homes, and grow operations. Agents are gathering evidence to prove their theory that Colombian drug cartels are coming to the state of Colorado and using the front of legal marijuana to make money illegally. No way. What a shock. Now, they report that marijuana, believe it or not, is often sold for twice as much on the black market in states where it is not legal. And even in Colorado, it's sold on the black market and the taxes are not collected nor paid by these Colombian gangsters. I know, it's shocking to think that this could be happening. So apparently what's happening is the cartels are coming here and they're, I'm sure they're filling up pickup trucks with legally grown and packaged pot in there. Well, they're driving it all over the country. As a matter of fact, I think they report on, yeah. Delivering it to many other states. But the businessmen and women here in Colorado who are in the dope business, they have their defenders. Meg Collins is the executive director of the Cannabis Business Alliance. And she says, oh, no, there are safeguards in place here to prevent drug trafficking, such as seed-to-sale tracking. And she considers the increase in all these marijuana smuggling busts, she says it's really a good thing. She says it shows the vigilance by law enforcement. It's not that the cartels are coming in here to set up shop where they can legally grow it and package it and process it and then sneak it out the back door. It's not that. It's just that law enforcement is more vigilant and the Cannabis Business Alliance is actually encouraged because they don't want competition from the black market. So I'm sure they hope that the police are doing all they can. Do I have any? Oh, yes. Such a from the Cannabis Business Alliance. She says, if you legalize marijuana in every state in the country, well, then you're not going to see people transshipping across borders because it's legal. And then you can get it anywhere in your state and it'll all be legal and everything will be happy and good. Now, the USA Today notes that such a change, legalizing marijuana nationwide, would require congressional action. And my bold prediction for the week is that within 5 years, marijuana will be legalized throughout the nation. And Republicans will vote for it. Yes, they will. And they'll come up with interesting tax policies. What they'll complain about is that the Democrats want to tax it too high. That'll be the Republican talking point. Let us legalize marijuana because we'll keep the taxes low. Anyway, within 5 years, if not nationwide, I would predict that at least half the states will have legalized dope. And then the debate will move on to exactly how do we legalize crystal meth? How do we legalize cocaine and heroin in a responsible manner so that the state can benefit from the tax revenue and the people can be free? Because politicians, they like a stoned populace. That's right. The more drug-addled the voting population is, the better it is for people like Nancy Pelosi. I mean, look at Nancy Pelosi. Who could vote for Nancy Pelosi if they were not on medication? Street or otherwise. I mean, look at this person. How do people like this get elected? I'll tell you why. How? Drugs. That's right. And so the politicians will work very hard, I think, to shore up their base of support amongst the drug-addled. And it will be the normal people who are left, who haven't gone tranny, who still have children and raise families and go to work. It'll be we who suffer. The politicians will do quite well. Yes, yes, they came to do good, and they've done quite well indeed. as someone once said. All right, now let's move on into the personhood file. Got a story here out of Indianapolis. Oh, this is a sports story that landed in the personhood file. Rumors have surfaced that an Indiana Pacers basketball player, the Breitbart says he's a superstar. His name is Paul George. I never heard of him. Have you heard of him? My extremely attractive audio engineer, who's very knowledgeable on the stats surrounding all the Pacers games, she's never heard of Paul George. So superstar may be a bit of a stretch, but he does play professional basketball for the Indiana Pacers. We'll give him that. Well, rumors have surfaced that he offered a stripper $1 million to abort his unborn child after he had cheated on the woman he was shacking up with. Yeah, see, he was shacking up regularly with another woman. Did he have any kids with the other woman? We don't know if they've had children together. All we know is they were shacking up on a regular basis, and they had some kind of agreement that while they weren't going to be married, they had agreed apparently not to, he had agreed or at least implied to her that he would not be going to strip clubs, taking strippers back to his hotel and things like that. Apparently there was some sort of social contract between the two, somewhat short of marriage. Right there in the firm shacking up space there. Representatives for superstar Paul George have denied that he paid anyone to abort his child. Now, you notice that. His representatives didn't deny that he paid this woman or offered this woman money. They say he didn't pay anyone to abort his child, which implies to me that he offered someone some amount of money. Let's face it. That statement implies that he offered the stripper some money to get an abortion. Okay, that's all. That is just my opinion. But when lawyers release these carefully crafted statements, and if you read them closely, a lot of times you can see the truth through the forest of lies that the lawyers are trying to throw at you. They say, no, he didn't pay anyone to abort his child. Well, that's not what we asked. Rumors surfaced that he offered the stripper money. Well, he didn't pay anyone to abort anyone. All right, well, that doesn't answer the question, Mr. Lawyer, but this is America, and you can just say something blatantly false and misleading on its face, and then you can just move on with your career. You can collect your fees. Mr. Paul George can keep throwing the round ball through the round hole and collecting his paycheck. And it's America. You can say whatever you want. Nobody's held responsible or accountable for anything. You can lie, bald-faced, in public, deceive and mislead, and just go right back to your regular activity. Ladies and gentlemen, move along. There's nothing to see here. Now, back to the story from Breitbart. As to the rumors that Mr. George may have impregnated the stripper, here's what he has to say. This is him himself, no lawyer involved here. George says, if and when there is legal confirmation that I am the father, I will fully embrace my responsibilities. So you could read that to say, yes, I got her pregnant, and as soon as it's proven in court, I'll pay the money. But he says, I hope you can respect my privacy. It's difficult to respect Mr. George's privacy because the stripper with whom he, the stripper has been posting pictures of herself. At now 7 months pregnant, she's been posting pictures of herself on social media outlets showing her pregnancy, her pregnant belly and all that. So not going to be a private affair, Mr. George. And apparently, the stripper has higher moral standards than Paul George. I mean, just apparently, if the rumors are true, and he offered her money to abort the baby, and she didn't take it, well, at least she's a better person than he is, I think. I don't know. It's kind of tough to judge in a case like this. Neither one of them are paragons of virtue. Let me get that straight. But the stripper wouldn't kill an innocent person over an unintended an extremely inconvenient pregnancy. So on this one, I'm going to give the stripper the edge over Paul George as a more decent human being. All right. So there we have that. Was there a point that I was going to make about that? I think there was a larger, deeper, more meaningful point that I was going to make, but it has gaped me. And perhaps I'll come back to it. One more from the sports file regarding John Elway. Let me just thank Mr. Elway and Mr. Fox, the brain trust that runs the Denver Broncos, as my extremely attractive audio engineer and I were driving last Sunday night, two Sunday nights ago, whenever, Super Bowl Sunday, we were driving. We were fleeing the polar vortex. And we had the distinct pleasure of listening to the most humiliating beatdown in NFL history. I'm sorry, in Super Bowl history, ever delivered against a favored team or even an underdog team. It qualifies in our economy as sports fans. And let me admit up front that my extremely attractive audio engineer and I, we're not the biggest sports fans in the world, okay? But the beatdown of the Denver Broncos by a team that I had never even heard of. I mean, I heard of them, but anyway, it qualifies as the 22nd most exciting football moment of our sports fan careers. Yeah, the first 21 most exciting on our list, those were delivered in the 2010 to 2011 season by the Denver Broncos when Tim Tebow was the quarterback. But the beatdown of the Broncos squarely in there at number 22, most thrilling football moment consumed by the McBurneys. Thank you very much, Mr. Elway and Mr. Fox. And to what's the quarterback's name there? Peyton Manning. To Peyton Manning, we are sorry for you that you have gotten mixed up with a bunch of people as John Elway and John Fox. We're so sorry. And I can't blame you for taking the $95 million, okay? Because it's just football. It's not as if you made an immoral decision, Mr. Manning. But it's just unfortunate that at this point in your career, when you should have topped your career off with a glorious Super Bowl victory, that you found out that you were mixed up with a brain trust like Elway and Fox. It's very unfortunate for you, Mr. Manning, and we will not hold it against you. Now, on to the story about John Elway. John Elway, Broncos Executive Vice President of Football Operations, says he would have no problem having openly homosexual college football player Michael Sam on his team. John Elway says, I've got no problem drafting an open homosexual onto my team. He says, quote, I applaud Michael Sam, and I wish him the very best as he continues the pursuit of his NFL dream, said John Elway just this past Monday. Hey, maybe Elway will not only have him drafted, maybe Elway will have Sam move in with him after he drafts him. Perhaps, right? John's a very open. Well, I'm just saying, I mean, hey, Elway's wife, she left him. And if you remember now, you folks who don't live in Denver, you probably weren't privy to a lot of the talk that was going around when Janet Elway called it quits and left John. But if you go back and you read the articles and the interviews with Janet, she consistently mentions the fact that she had a problem. She didn't like sharing John. And she also implies on a number of occasions that it wasn't just sharing him with the fans or with the team or with the road trips. She didn't like sharing John. Yeah. Anyway, I mean, and I don't know what personally went on between them. I'm just telling you what I perceive as I'm sitting here as an outsider looking in and someone who is no doubt biased against John Elway. Don't like John Elway, not a fan. Used to be a fan, but then I got to know the guy. Anyway, maybe Elway drafts Michael Sam and they move in together. And if you promise to love so completely, and you said you would always be true, It's the Weekly Worldview, and we're back. I'm Doug McBurney. Welcome. Round in second. And for third, here is keeping in with the sports theme of the middle of the show here. Was I too hard on John? Do you think I might have said something for which not hard enough? Oh, as my extremely attractive audio engineers. Well, you know where she stands. Up to the Super Bowl. Made it clear to a lot of my friends how much I disliked them. And he sent me an email. I think it was my other brother, Daryl, as a matter of fact. I don't have a big circle of friends. I got like two or three people that I communicate with regularly. Everybody else, I'm pretty much out of the loop. And I think Daryl said, Doug, you think you're being hypocritical? Because if Tim Tebow was still the quarterback, you'd be rooting for John Elway and John Fox to win the Super Bowl. But the thing is, it was his throwing of Tebow under the bus that revealed how evil the Elway Fox brain trust was. See, I didn't know before then. None of us knew that they were untrustworthy, devious liars. Now, I did know about the allegations about the strippers and the adultery, though. No, my extremely attractive audio engineer didn't know. And that just shows you how sports can distort your thinking. Yeah, I should have been hoping that Elway and Fox would get rid of Tebow from the very beginning because Tebow was too good to be associated with them. But so desperate was I to have a Super Bowl winning team in my town that I was willing to overlook the obvious flaws and character distortions that run shot through John Elway. All right, well, enough of that. I don't know that that was of any benefit to anyone, but I wanted to get that off my chest. All right. By the way, Denver Bible Church, this morning, what's today? Today is the 16th of February. You should get this sermon. In fact, it was the third sermon in a three-sermon tour de force that Pastor Bob's been doing for the last 3 weeks. Now, we've been on the road. We missed the first two. So, of course, we're going to purchase the entire three-sermon series. He did a series on faith, hope, and love. For those of you who are King James only, faith, hope, and charity, right? Charity is love. In the New King James, it's they call it charity and love. Anyway, today, Pastor Bob, Denver Bible Church, gave a powerful, motivating, inspirational sermon on love and what love really is. And here's the thing about Christianity. You can wander into just about any church with a cross on it on any given Sunday, and you'll hear a sermon about love. Love and love and love and love and forgive and love. Love, forgiveness, and forgive and love. And that's all well and good, but there is simply not another Bible teacher alive today, in my opinion, who can better express and explain to a congregation what love really is, what love really means, what the statement God is love, what does that mean? There simply is no one else, no one better, in my opinion. And I can't wait to purchase the entire series and go back and listen to the faith, the hope, and the love. The greatest of these three, by the way, is love. Anyway, very good powerhouse sermon given at Denver Bible Church today, February 16th. Go online, buy it. You should get it if you don't attend. And during the sermon, Pastor Bob punctuated the sermon at the beginning, at the middle, and at the end with stories about mothers who were pregnant and faced with the choice of ending their pregnancy in order to save their life because they had various medical conditions. They were told by the doctors, end your pregnancy, abort your baby, and then we can treat you and save your life. Three women who faced this situation, three women who chose to risk their lives in order that their child might live. And at least one of them died as a result of waiting and delaying treatment in order that her baby might be born. At least one of them actually died. The other two, if I'm not mistaken, risked their lives so that their baby could live. Very inspirational stuff. And gets right down to that, to answering that question, what is love? It's not just a romantic, warm feeling. Love is acting for the good of another, desiring the good for another, for a person, yourself and other people. That's what love is. Anyway, just an inspirational sermon, and this story I'm about to read brings that to mind. It's from the Personhood File. Doctors, this is from CNN, doctors delivered a brain-dead Canadian woman's son earlier this month, and she died the next day. The case drew some comparisons to the case of Marlise Munoz in Texas. You remember that story. She was a pregnant woman declared brain dead. And her family chose to kill her and the child. Well, in this case, Robin Benson, in this case from Canada, Robin Benson had complained of a terrible headache and sent her husband out to get some Tylenol. When he came back from the store, she was unresponsive but still breathing. The hospital and the doctors discovered that she had suffered a brain hemorrhage, and she was later declared brain dead. The husband was left. She was on a ventilator, keeping her heart and lungs functioning, and he was left, according to this article from CNN, counting down the days until the birth of his son and the death of his wife. See, this father chose to keep the woman alive, to keep his wife alive, to give the baby a chance to live. Now, you remember in the Munoz case, here's what CNN reports. In the Munoz case, her husband wanted her taken off the ventilator, and the hospital acknowledged that the fetus she carried was not viable. But in the Benson situation up in Canada, family members and doctors agreed to keep the ventilator, to keep her on the ventilator, until they could deliver the baby. And, according to CNN anyway, the baby was growing normally. Now, nowhere in this article does the father say that that had anything to do with his decision. I have a feeling it did not. I have a feeling he would have done it just the way he did it, even if they said, hey, the baby could be sick, the baby could be deformed, the baby could have some disabilities. And maybe it's just, I hope that's not the case. I hope he would have done it anyway. So this family in Texas, Munoz family, they killed the baby because the baby may not have been a perfect baby. The baby may have been sick, may not have lived very long. And of course, that's the case with every baby. Babies are born, they have disabilities, they get sick, they die. There's that risk with every pregnancy. But it's all a matter of where your heart is. And if you believe that that unborn child is a person to whom you are responsible, to God ultimately, then it changes what you do, and you could be a hero. You see, the three women who are described in Pastor Bob's sermon at Denver Bible Church this morning, those are heroes. When you lay down your life or you risk your life for another person, you're a hero. That's a heroic act. That's an eternally heroic act. But if you don't believe it's a person, you end up making the selfish, wicked, evil choice that the Munoz family made in killing the mom and the child for their own selfish, wicked reasons. Anyway, so that's why personhood is so important, is because understanding our responsibility toward our fellow man, especially that fellow man who is smaller and defenseless and maybe even under threat, understanding our responsibility toward that person, it makes us better people. It makes society a better society. And it gives us and our children a better opportunity to know God. I had a friend tell me, I asked him about his kids last week. And he said, he told me what his kids were up to. I hadn't seen him in years. He said, main thing for me is that my kids are happy. I want them to be happy. If they're happy, then that's fine, whatever they want to do. And I said, the thing with my kids is that they know God. And anyway, that's more important to me than if they're happy. I do want them to be happy. Don't get me wrong. I want my kids to be happy. But it's more important to me that they know God. And understanding the reality of human life and what it is, scientifically, biologically, morally, spiritually, all that, I think puts them in a better position to know God. And that probably puts, well, it definitely puts them in a better position to be happy in the long run. Might be inconvenient and even uncomfortable at times here on this mortal plane. But when you take the long view, if you want your children to be happy, you need to make sure that you do your best to ensure that they know God. That's the real key, in my opinion. Now, let's go to the science. Really? File. This is from The Independent over in the United Kingdom. Scientists at Oxford University say they found a region of the brain that makes you wonder if you've done something wrong. Yeah. It's called the lateral frontal pole. Yeah, and it's unique to humans. Yes. They tested monkeys, and monkeys don't have it. Yep. It's this lateral frontal pole. Makes you wonder if you've done something wrong. Unique to humans. The Independent article goes on. For centuries, we thought that the conscience was just some faculty of moral insight in the human mind, an innate sense that one was behaving well or badly. Although the great H.L. Mencken once defined it as the inner voice which warns us that someone may be looking. That's what Mencken said about it. Now, it's been used by religions as a numinous something or other, kindly bestowed by God to give humans a choice between sin and paradise. Yeah, well, that paragraph was obviously written by some ignorant heathen. They're hitting around it there, but that's not really what religion depicts the conscience as. The conscience is the innate knowledge of God. And is there a biological component to it? Hey, there probably is. There probably is. In fact, this article says, thanks to neuroscience, we found the actual physical thing itself. Perhaps we have discovered the conscience. Now, they go on to talk about how this may have evolved, and that's how this ended up in the Science Really file. And we're not going to go into fantastical tales and fairy tales about how why monkeys don't have it and how we may have evolved it and why. We won't go into any of that. I just want to point out that this lateral frontal pole that they've discovered, have two of them, two lateral frontal poles. One behind each eyebrow. Interesting. That the conscience, the physical manifestation of the conscience, perhaps, is in the forehead? Anyway, this goes all the way back to my whole mark of the beast theory. And that the mark of the beast may not be a physical mark. It might just be a spiritual mark right there on your forehead. Welcome back to Weekly Worldview. Live version from the Power Trio from Toronto there. Thank you, boys. Put that guitar away. We'll go back to the news. Now, is it going to get depressing? Because if it's going to get depressing, I might just have to. Well, we'll go to the justice file. Of course it's going to get depressing. Jose Reyes is a 16-year-old boy in the Houston area. This is from the Associated Press, and he and another juvenile, I'm sorry, Jose Reyes and a 16-year-old juvenile face capital murder charges in the death of Corian Cervantes there in the Houston area. Authorities say that after the boys lured young Corian, female, Cervantes to a vacant apartment in southeast Houston back in February, on February 5th, they hit her with an ashtray, they beat her with a toilet lid and a window blind rod, they strangled her, and stabbed her in the face with a screwdriver. This is a 15-year-old Houston girl murdered in such a vicious fashion. Now, the younger perpetrator had heard Reyes claim that he had sold his soul to the devil and that he wanted his young friend to do the same. So the teenage boys, apparently, were hoping to make a deal with the devil and sell their soul to the devil. And part of the ritual, this satanic ritual, involved the murder of this young girl. So Cervantes, I see, he's 17. 17-year-old Jose Reyes and his 16-year-old friend in this satanic pact murdered this 15-year-old Corian Cervantes. Unbelievable. Cervantes and the 16-year-old boy who killed her had apparently attended the same school. And because Reyes and the younger boy are under 18, they are not eligible for the death penalty, according to the Associated Press and according to the confused lawyers running the state of Texas. But they are eligible for the death penalty, and they will get it. They just won't get it in due time from the due authorities who should mete it out to them. But they will get it. And on that day, should they not repent, we will celebrate as the vengeance of an almighty and living God is poured out upon them in a manner far more horrific than what they did to this girl. Yes, I will celebrate. On to the domestic tranquility file. So an actor died of a heroin overdose, an actor I had never heard of. In fact, let me just ask my extremely attractive. She says, I never heard of him. His name is Philip Seymour Hoffman. Apparently a very famous person. He was in a movie about some homosexual New York art dealer or something. I wanted to bring this up. This is from the Daily Mail over in the United Kingdom. New York City police, who searched actor Philip Seymour Hoffman's West Village apartment after he was found dead back on February 2nd, discovered two small diaries. In the journals, Hoffman talked about feeling caught in between his longtime shack-up girlfriend Mimi and another woman. His affair may have led Mimi, who is the girl he was shacking up with, and had kids with, I think. Mimi kicked him out of their home about 3 months before he died of a heroin. So he went into a downward spiral of guilt and drugs and all of that, and he was cheating again on the girl that he was shacking up with. It's just sad. You know, one of the leading causes of injury and death in America between people who are in relationships is infidelity and sexual immorality. It's just never covered as such. If the Centers for Disease Control were to actually keep statistics on infidelity and sexual immorality's impact on people's health and lives, it would be a leading cause of injury, sickness, death, drug abuse, all of that. And despite the fact that this article from the Daily Mail is widely available, I mean, I think I got it off Drudge. It's not like nobody could see the story. It will not be a part of the fabric of the story of the tragic end of Philip Seymour Hoffman. Because, well, I don't know why. People just refuse to see it. They don't want to talk about it. Nobody wants to admit that infidelity and sexual immorality is dangerous, and it kills people. Famous and infamous and just ordinary everyday people. All the time, every day. It's an epidemic. But it's rarely reported on. Let's see here. All right. Do I want to do this story about my Marine Corps? I'll do this briefly. Throughout much of 2013, the Marine Corps Times, which is a newspaper that we used to buy when we lived on base overseas because there was nothing else to read. And it was all about how you could have a career and how you could maximize your benefits. And they also reported on the hierarchy within the Corps, who was getting promoted, who became the commandant, who took over this division or battalion or whatever. I mean, it was interesting. I read it a lot when I was in the service. Well, throughout much of 2013, the Marine Corps Times had published dozens of articles as part of an ongoing investigation into allegations that the commandant of the Marine Corps, James Amos, had abused his authority in punishing Marines for embarrassing war zone scandals. One in particular was the Marines who urinated on the dead bodies of the Taliban. That sticks out in my mind. Numerous reports had captured the attention of the mainstream media, and outfits like NPR, CNN, and Time magazine were reporting on news broken by the Marine Corps Times newspaper. And Mr. Amos was getting fairly embarrassed, being a political hack functionary. Anyone who would be commandant of the Marine Corps under Barack Obama must be suspect. I'm sorry. One source said, it's no secret in the Pentagon that the commandant does not like the Marine Corps Times. And they had to speak on condition of anonymity. Why? Because, well, it's the commandant. So now, fiscal guidance for 2014, issued back in October of last year, specifically prohibits commands from using operation and maintenance funds for purchasing subscriptions to the Marine Corps Times, and the Marine Corps Times newspaper has been removed from its prominent newsstand location at the base exchange stores and placed instead in areas away from checkout lines so that the troops can't see the investigative reporting on their commandant. Functionary bureaucrat hack, Obama sycophant, James Amos. Now, there are wire racks in the front of the, well, we used to call it the PX. Apparently they call it the base exchange. There are wire racks and bins at the front of the PX that are only authorized to display the Marine Corps exchange promotional materials. And according to the new policy, exchange managers were told to remove the Marine Corps Times newspapers to make room for the commandant's reading list and the reading list of the First Lady of the Marine Corps, Amos's wife, Bonnie. Now, there's this term I never heard of, First Lady of the Marine Corps. Now, it's possible I wasn't paying attention. I was not the most gung-ho Marine in the unit by any means. But I don't know when this term came into circulation. I never heard of it. Anyway, the racks from which the Marine Corps Times newspapers were removed remained empty as of the last report, according to the Marine Corps Times, which is where I got this story. So the racks are now empty, and the Marine Corps Times is being hidden in the back of the PX. This is the Soviet Union. This is what a Soviet general would have done if there was any reportage on his behavior. It's unbelievable. The Marine Corps has been corrupted to a degree beyond which it never has been corrupted before. And for those of you who think that the American military will not shoot American citizens if they're told to do so, I think you're mistaken. And I wouldn't have held that position just a few years ago. But I think you're probably mistaken at this point. And I don't think you should be building a bunker and getting prepared for the government to crack. Because believe me, folks, if the government decides to tell the Marines to come and shoot you, there's really not much you can do. Okay, no, I don't care how much of a bunker you have, you know. Anyway, but this is very disturbing, and it bothers me a lot to read that story, that kind of thing could be going on in what I thought was an institution that was, at least to some degree, beyond the reaches of the corrupting influence of the Obama administration and all of these minions. All right, now, I want to end with something that's a little, well, it's just, it's disturbing, actually, but I think it puts things into perspective. This is from Longview, Washington, and this is a story from the end of last month, and I've been holding on to it for a couple of weeks, just because it's just a gripping tale. A Longview, Washington man is recovering from serious injuries after he was sent through a wood chipper at work. Yeah, he climbed into a wood chipper that was turned off to retrieve an object that was stuck down in the shredding device's claws and teeth. Something that him and his co-workers had done before. However, someone was not aware that he was inside the barrel-sized machine. And the spikes and claws inside the device were turned back on with him inside. His name is Frank Arce, and he says he heard the machine click back on, and he knew there was no escape. And here's what he says. He says, actually, oh, by the way, his injuries are severe. He is expected to live, but he'll probably remain in the hospital for the next few weeks. He has a broken pelvis, 7 broken ribs, a shattered ankle, a bruised liver, a broken leg, a collapsed lung, and a deep cut that runs the entire length of the back of his body. He has a crushed knee and remains on heavy dose of pain medication. He says, quote, actually, going through the machine itself wasn't the worst part. He says, what was the worst part was the not knowing what was going to happen. So the terror of the unknown, to him, is more vibrant in his mind, more memorable at that moment when you're going through a wood chipper. The not knowing, the fear, the terror of the unexpected sticks out more in his mind than the actual physical pain of being dragged through the claws and the spikes of the wood chipper. Supporting the axiom that my pastor gave a great sermon on, that pain is not merely physical, and that psychological and spiritual pain can often be far more painful than mere physical pain. Anyway, that's it. That's the Weekly Worldview for this week. I want to thank you all for joining me and my extremely attractive audio engineer. I want to thank KGov, Denver Bible Church, and American Right to Life, and of course my other brother Daryl, who makes it all happen here at the Weekly Worldview Studios. Should the Lord tarry, we will return next week, and until then, may the grace of God go with you, and may the peace of Jesus Christ be upon you.